For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
It is September the 17th. We are in Parshas Kedoshim, page 662, at the top of the page. Pasuk Yutes, verse 19. Es chukosai tishmoru, you shall guard my chukim, which they translate as decrees. Okay, so as many of you know, the word chok implies a mitzvah that we do not fully grasp the reason for the mitzvah. The truth is we don't fully grasp the reason for any mitzvah, but here we have very little understanding behind the mitzvah, as opposed to, let's say, the mitzvah of not stealing, where there we understand that if people's property are not property rights are not respected, you can't have a functioning society. But these are mitzvahs that we do not understand the reason for. And we're going to here have a list, not an exhaustive list, but many of the cases where you're not allowed to mix certain things. Your animals, you should not crossbreed as kilayim, which means two different species. To crossbreed them is prohibited. Sad chalo sizra kilayim, your field, you shall not mix its seeds. Uveged kilayim sha'adnez, and a clothing that is kilayim, that is mixed together, of course we know it's talking about wool and linen, is what we call sha'adnez. Sha'adnez, we'll explain what that means in a minute. Lo ya'ale alecha, it shall not be brought up upon you. Can't wear wool and linen together. As I said, this is not an exhaustive list. We know that, for example, there's another prohibition against having two different types of animals pull an item together, pull a plow, pull a cart. That's also prohibited. We, of course, know the classic prohibited mixture is milk and meat is another one. But this is some of them here. So here we include crossbreeding animals. We include mixing seeds in the ground and mixing wool and linen. Now, just because there's a prohibition against mixing them does not mean that they all have the same rules, meaning that some of them you can't mix, but if they were mixed, you can derive benefit from the result. Others you can't mix, and if they were mixed, you cannot derive benefit from the results.
What's the criterion?
Just what the Torah says. So in this list over here, you may not crossbreed animals. If two animals were in fact crossbred, I assume that's the past tense of crossbreed, then and offspring is produced, you can use the offspring. That's why a mule can be used, even though you're not allowed to produce a mule. You're not allowed to crossbreed a donkey and a horse to produce a mule, but if somebody did, even though one is not allowed to do it, the mule is permitted. You're allowed to use the mule for your service in order to pull, carry a load or whatever it is. So it may not be done, but its result is permitted. That is with crossbreeding animals. Similarly, when it comes to mixing seeds in the ground, there it is prohibited to do it, but when grapes are not involved, and this is not talking about with grapes, this is talking about just seeds, wheat, barley, etc., one cannot do it. If one did it, then again, the result is permitted, even though one should not do it. Then, the third category here is just the opposite. Wool and linen, there is no prohibition to mix wool and linen. You can make as many garments as you wish that have wool and linen together. You just can't wear them. But you're allowed to make the garment. There's nothing wrong with the act of weaving wool and linen together. The problem is wearing the wool and linen that has been woven together. So these three prohibitions are not the same in that the first two, the prohibition is against doing it, not against benefiting from the result. Whereas the third one, the problem is benefiting from the result, not doing it. Not all benefiting from the result, it's just the benefit of wearing it that is prohibited. It's not prohibited to get other types of benefit if there is one. Let's say to make a wool and linen garment and then sell it to a non-Jew, that would be permitted because one is allowed to derive benefit from wool and linen that has been sewn together, woven together. There may be a problem there that eventually it could be sold to a Jew. That's a different discussion. But as far as the basic bare bones of the halacha, it would be permitted to make a wool and linen garment and then sell it to a non-Jew. But you cannot crossbreed an animal. You can't crossbreed a horse and a donkey to create a mule, even if your intention is to use it to give to a non-Jew. It doesn't make a difference. You're not allowed to crossbreed. Some say, as we've mentioned before, even non-Jews are not allowed to crossbreed animals. That would be one of the prohibitions for the Bnei Noach. One of the Noachide laws would be against crossbreeding. That is one of the opinions in the Gemara. So it's something which cannot be done. But if it was done, whether a Jew did it or a non-Jew did it, one is permitted to benefit from the result. Yeah.
Do you have to keep them intentionally separate in your barn? Or can they be together and it just...
I don't know the answer to the question. I don't know if they would naturally crossbreed. That I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know what happens with animals in that way. By comparison, so milk and meat, you're not allowed to cook together, and if they were cooked together, you can't derive benefit from them. So there you have, on both ends, you have a problem. You can't do it, and if it was done, whether you did it or someone else did it, you cannot derive benefit from it. So there, it's a broader prohibition. grafting fruits would be similar to this case of mixing seeds, right? Where it would be prohibited to do it, but fruits that grow from the result of grafting would be permitted. Grafting fruits, of course, I mean two different types of fruits. You're allowed to graft apples and apples, but grafting two different types of fruits to produce a tangerine, to produce a nectarine, those sorts of things, you're not allowed to do it, but if it was done, you're allowed to benefit, which is why one is allowed to purchase those fruits and eat them. That is fine, but you're not allowed to make those fruits. I'll get to your question in just a moment, but if the crossbreeding of seeds, the mixing of seeds includes grapes, then the result would be prohibited. One would not allow to derive benefit from the resulting kilei hakerem, which would be when a vine becomes mixed with other seeds. Yeah.
So Rabbi Kransky, I'm trying to understand what you're saying. You're saying that if someone knowing this prohibition and intentionally, knowingly does it, then you're still allowed to benefit from it?
Yeah, because
to understand why that is.
Because the prohibition is doing it, not the result of it.
Well, the prohibition is the doing, and the reason you do something is to benefit from it.
That's true.
And you're saying that just the doing itself is the big deal and not the result.
Right. That's right. You have other examples of this. There are certain types of averos where the result is prohibited, but other types, the result is not prohibited, even though one should not have done what they did. But once it's done, it's done. One who deliberately violates Shabbos. Now there is a prohibition against using the result of a deliberate violation of Shabbos. However, it doesn't apply equally. It depends on who did it and whether the person who did it wants to drive benefit or someone else wants to drive benefit, or whether one waits until after Shabbos, the amount of time it would have taken to do it after Shabbos. There's all kinds of rules with that. if someone steals, so that money has to be returned. We know that a mitzvah cannot be performed with an item that has been stolen. but the stolen money is not prohibited to derive benefit from. It's that one is not allowed to do a mitzvah with it, but one and one has to return it in order to fix the avera. But there's no isser hanah, there's no prohibition of deriving benefit that attaches itself to the item that was stolen. So it depends on the situation. Every case is different about whether the result of the avera is also a problem. Depends on the case.
It was so exciting on Shabbos. I'm walking to shul, and there's a big, shiny quartz. It was so beautiful. I mean, it wasn't a penny. I mean, I get excited about a penny because I grew up with nothing. So to me, a penny is, I always bend down and pick up a penny. But there was a quarter, 25 pennies. And it was just so exciting that I could, know that I have nothing to do with that. I can't do anything with that. It was just so exciting to be able to fill that mitzvah.
Very good. Very good. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech haolam,
shekol v'olam. In that case, depending where the quarter was, would she have been allowed to just let something drop on top of it?
Yeah,
and then it depends. After Shabbos come back?
Yeah, you could even stand there with your foot on top of it until Shabbos ends. You could do that if you wish.
But that's not the real kavanah of Shabbos, actually.
Depends. What if it's $100 bill? You're allowed to do it. Gemara speaks about it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, you're allowed to do it. I mean, it depends when you find it. If you find it, an hour before Shabbos is over, it might be worth it. If you find it Friday night, I'm not so sure that it's what you want to do.
It's not in the spirit of Shabbos.
Now, the crossbreeding animals, as we mentioned, would be different species, would be prohibited. The case of the seeds also, different types of seeds would be prohibited. With clothing, with garments, it's only wool and linen together. We know that from other psukim in the Torah, that it is only wool and linen that is a problem. And again, it is not a problem to actually make the clothing, it's a problem to wear it after it is made, and it doesn't matter who made it. Whether a Jew made it or a non-Jew made it, it makes no difference. Wool and linen together, one cannot wear. Now it says sha'atnez. Sha'atnez, the Gemara says, or as we say, sha'atnez. Sha'atnez is a contraction of three words. Shua, tavoy, nuz. Shua, tavoy, nuz. Run together is sha'atnez. Mm-hmm. So what does shua mean? What does tavoy mean? What does nuz mean? Shua means combed or prepared. When you have wool or linen, as the linen grows from the plant and the wool grows on the back of the sheep and you shear it off, it is not usable at that time to make real clothing out of it. You could take the clumps of wool and linen and you could try to make them into a garment. They're not going to weave well because they're not made into threads yet. And in order to make wool into thread, you have to first comb it out to get it into a usable form, and then you have to spin it into threads. So if you make a garment using unprocessed wool, it would not be included in the Torah prohibition of shatnez. Now, there may be rabbinic prohibitions, but we're talking here on the Torah level, not on the rabbinic level. On the Torah level, it would have to be processed wool that's ready to be used. That includes shua, which is combed, and tavoy, which is spun. Because you take the individual strands of wool, those little strands of wool are not strong enough to be considered a thread. You take several strands of wool and you spin it and you create a thread. A thread is made up of many strands of wool. So in order for the garment to be prohibited, it has to be made out of wool and linen that have been processed, which means combed out, and also spun into thread. That's shua, combed, tavoy, spun. What does nuz mean? That is a machlokas. Two opinions on what the word nuz means. One opinion is that nuz means that the threads themselves are then spun together to make what we would call, I guess, a string. I'm not sure what you would call the next product. Thread is used for sewing. But for for weaving, you need something thicker.
A yarn.
I guess so. Yarn, something, I don't know how thick it actually has to be, but the woof and the weft, right? Is that the right words? I believe. Those for weaving, those are made up, each of those is made up in turn of many threads. Mm-hmm. So you have many strands of wool which are spun together to make one thread, and then many threads are spun together to make those two directional parts of weaving. And that is, according to one opinion, what the word nuz means, that it would have to be made into these a little bit thicker types of, again, I don't know if the word is thread or something thicker than that. That's one opinion for what the word nuz means.
Now, is that wool and linen together, or it could be a piece of all wool made thicker, a piece of all linen made thicker?
So, according to this opinion, the wool would be all wool thicker, and then the okay. linen all thicker, and then it's woven together. The other opinion is that nuz means woven together. That when you take the two, the wool and the linen, and then you weave them, then that's what nuz would mean. Sha'an is. So essentially what you see from here is that in order for to have the total prohibition of sha'aniz, you have to have a processed garment. It doesn't have to be processed on an assembly line. It can be processed in a person's home, but it is processed. If it is raw material that has not been processed properly, although there may be rabbinic prohibitions, it will not fit the Torah prohibition of sha'aniz, of wool and linen together. Another point is that wool and linen is only a problem when it is the same garment. If it is separate garments, even though one is wearing a wool garment and a linen garment, that is not the Torah prohibition of sha'aniz. It has to be the same garment. Now, it doesn't have to be that the garment is full of wool and linen. Even if there's only one strand of linen in a wool garment, that will be a problem. That is an issue. And that's why we get our clothing when it's clothing that is likely or that is possible to have sha'aniz. We get it checked and we get the areas. What happens is when the sha'aniz checker checks clothing, he doesn't check the entire garment, then it would mean unraveling the entire garment. What they do is they take samples from different parts of the garment where it is most likely to have sha'aniz. So I know for men's clothing, I don't know women's clothing, but for a 100% wool suit, a man's 100% wool suit, so 100% means basically, but it doesn't really mean exclusively. There are strands and threads that could be from another garment, particularly in the areas that are not the main part of the suit. So they will check under the collar of the suit, because there has to be a thickening type of garment in the collar to hold the collar in place. That sometimes has linen. And then they'll also check down at the hem of the jacket. Down at the hem, they'll open up over there and check inside. So there are certain parts of the garment that are more likely to have linen, and that's what they will check in order to see if there is linen in the garment. So it doesn't have to be that the entire garment is full of linen. Even if it's just one strand of linen, it would be a problem. And that's why they check what they check. So it's wool and linen that is made together into one garment. If it's two separate garments, then it is fine. Now, rabbinically, there is a prohibition against wearing wool, two garments, one wool and one linen. But here's the interesting trick. That is only if one cannot remove each garment without removing the other garment. So what does that mean? That means one who wears a wool pair of pants or a wool skirt and a linen shirt, since those two garments can be removed independently of each other, that is permitted. It is permitted to wear a linen shirt and a wool pair of pants or a wool skirt. That would be fine, because each one is independent of the other and they can be removed each one independently of the other. But to wear a linen shirt and a wool jacket would be a problem, because even though one can take off the wool jacket without taking off the linen shirt. One cannot remove the linen shirt without first removing the wool jacket. So there would be a rabbinic prohibition against doing that. But that's, again, that's only rabbinic. From the Torah, there would be no problem because it's two separate garments. It's only the same garment that runs into a problem of shatness. You can get into all kinds of details, which we're not going to get into tonight, partially because we don't want to get sidetracked and partially because I don't know all the laws. But you can, the Gemara discusses what if the garment is made up of wool and then another material, let's say cotton, and then linen. So is that a problem? Is that considered to be one garment, two garments? How do you deal with that? Right? You can get into all kinds of discussions on this sort of thing. Leather in the middle, you know, you can get into the... But that's the basic idea. You have a question.
There's a spinning wheel at the Tully Smith House. I don't know if y'all have been there or not. And it shows you how they have the wool and how they spin it into either a thread or a yarn or something.
Have nice. Okay.
It's very nice. It's over here at the Atlanta History Center.
Nancy Levy, she spins.
Does she really?
She sometimes brings it and shows it to the children in school.
Wow.
Wow. It is so cool.
Really?
Yeah.
Does she do the? I think I have the words correct. The wolf and the weft. Does she do them? Does she do them different? Because the Gemara indicates that they're done slightly differently.
I don't know. She will bring in like this ball of whatever and spin it out and then spin it together. I don't know. Like with her.
Nice.
Spinning
them. That'd be nice to see. Okay. Really, really okay.
But when it's not so fine, it's a very coarse. I saw one time we went travels and it shows a sample. A very coarse type of spun material. It had a lot of little, you know, balls in it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very rough. So does the Gemara explain why in the Beis HaMikdash the Kohanim were able to wear shatnez?
No, because the Torah says so. The Gemara doesn't explain why the Torah says it. The Torah says it. That's all. Yeah, that's a gzeiras hakasuv. The Torah says to do it. We are less than 150 years away, meaning from, in the past, from when clothing was produced primarily at home. And then everybody knew about spinning thread and about weaving and all these things. I mean, that was par for the course. Mm-hmm. It's only less than 150 years ago that it became more and more common to have clothing bought in stores. Yeah.
So, Rabbi Pransky, how do we accept the fact that the Kohen, Kohen Gadol's garments were allowed to have a mixture, if this is in the Torah?
It's in the Torah that the Kohen Gadol's garment should have a mixture.
Oh, it's in there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but not over here.
Not here, it's not here. In Parashas Tetzaveh, where the commandment for making the clothing is.
Oh, that's very nice. That sure simplifies things. So, but it's misleading to not say it here.
Well, I mean...
So you have to read the whole Torah.
You got
to
know the whole thing. Okay. Now it says lo yale alecha, which means it shall not be brought up upon you. How do they translate it? It shall not come upon you. So in theory, one could lay down on something made of wool and linen. It's only that one can't put it upon themselves. However, again, here you have a rabbinic prohibition because the problem is if you're lying down on a garment or a blanket or something like that that is made of wool and linen, and a thread, remember it only takes one thread. If one thread is jutting out and that thread lies upon your body, you know, leans against you, now that part is on you and you got a problem. So that's why the rabbis prohibited lying down on something made of wool and linen unless it is a hard item. If it's dried or hard or something like that, if it's rigid, so then there's nothing to worry about. But if it is a soft garment-like item, one should not sit or lie down on shatnez on something made of wool and linen. In theory, if one is traveling and a plush chair, let's say in an airplane or on a train or something like that, these days the chairs are not made so plush. But in the early days of travel, when this terms of travel, it was more of a luxury thing. So in theory, if the plushness has wool and linen, that could be a problem. It's a rare situation. I don't think one has to worry about that. But there, in theory, it could happen that a chair could be something which one would not be allowed to sit on because of how plush it is and that it is made of wool and linen together. That could, in theory, happen, although, it's, as I said, it is rare. Now, the prohibition, interestingly, is to derive benefit from wearing it, which means when you wear it, how does wearing clothing give you benefit? So first of all, it warms the body. That's the primary function of clothing, is that it protects and warms the body. The basic function is it keeps the body warm. Obviously, there's sneers as well, but it keeps the body warm. And then there's also a function of what it makes us look like, the appearance that we have, that it makes us look a certain way. It makes us look good. It makes us look dressed up. It makes us look casual. Different types of clothing give a certain look to a person. So, but the primary function of the clothing is to warm the body. So the Gemara actually speaks about a person who is selling garments. The person selling garments, they're selling shatnez garments to non-Jews. Again, that is permitted. One is allowed to sell shatnez garments to non-Jews. In the absence of a mannequin, then the way that you would show how clothing looks is you would put it on yourself and say, look, this is the way the jacket looks, and put it on. So the Gemara discusses that if a person, if the weather is, let's say, warm, and putting on the jacket would not give the person benefit. The person would not enjoy the wearing of the jacket. And the purpose of putting it on is just to show what it looks like, but not for one's own goal of wearing a garment. It might be permitted to put on the shatnez jacket in the warm weather to show the non-Jewish buyer or would-be buyer what it looks like.
Well, if it's cold outside.
If it's cold outside, then one can't do that because then one is driving benefit.
Benefit from it.
Right. Then one is getting the warmth from it. But if not, then it may be permitted to do so. Now, again, we don't do it because it's too complicated and who knows what this is. But I'm just showing you that the prohibition is against wearing it and wearing it for the benefit of wearing the clothing. That's where the prohibition comes. Okay. Pasuk Chaf. Now, the next three psukim concern themselves with a very specific case. And our sages actually have to piece this together to figure out what the case is. In the spirit of Parashas Kedoshim, it is a brand new rule, not one that seems to be directly related to what we just spoke about. So I'm going to read all three together, and then we'll go back and say what it is talking about. V'ish kishkavas isha shichvas zera. A man will have a relationship with a woman, a physical relation, an intimate relation with a woman. V'hi shifcha necherefes l'ish. And she is a woman. She's a shifcha. She's a maid. Necherefes l'ish, which they translate as
designated
for another man. So she's a maid servant, who has been designated for a different man. V'hafdei lo niftasa. But redeemed, she has not been redeemed. She has not been redeemed. Ochufsha lo nitan la, or her freedom has not been granted to her. Bikores tiyeh, which they translate as, there shall be an investigation. Lo yum su, they shall not be put to death. Ki lo chupasha, for she had not been freed. So we're dealing here with a maid that there's a question about her freedom. But she's not been freed. She was designated to a different man, but then she had a willful relationship with somebody else. So there's an investigation. No death is meted out to either one of them because she was not freed. Clearly the implication is had she been freed, then the punishment here would have been death. But she was not freed, and therefore there is no punishment of death. The man who did this needs to bring a karban, a sacrifice of an asham. That's one of the types of sin offerings to Hashem. El Pesach al Moed, to the entrance of the tent of meeting, to the Mishkan. El asham, it is the ram of the asham. V'chiper olav ha-kohen be'el ha-asham b'fnei Hashem. The kohen shall atone for this man using this ram of an asham before Hashem, al chata so asher chata, for his sin that he sinned, v'nislach lo mechata so asher chata, and he shall be forgiven for the sin that he sinned. our sages explain to us that even though normally a carbon, a sacrifice, is only brought for an accidental or a negligent avera, not one that is done on purpose. Typically, if one does an avera on purpose, a sacrifice would not be the appropriate response. But here, a sacrifice is brought even when this is done on purpose. Even if the man doing it knew that it was wrong and did it anyway, he would still be required to bring a karban. And the karban is an asham. This is called the asham shifcha charufa, which means the asham of the maid who has been designated. Special asham in the Torah. Only for this type of avera, the asham is brought. Now the question is, what case are we talking about? The clues that we are given is that she is a maid, where she is designated to another man, and that she is not redeemed, but had she been free, then there would have been death over here. Which means, had she been free, then her designation would have made her a married woman, an eshes ish, and therefore this relationship would have been adultery, and both she and the man would have been put to death for adultery. But because she was not yet freed, therefore what has happened is not considered to be adultery, and instead there's a punishment of a sacrifice, and as we'll see, there's another punishment as well, but not death. So those are the clues. So we need to find a designation that a shifcha, that a maidservant can have to a particular man, that as long as she is a maid, she is not considered to be a married woman, but if she would have been freed, she would be considered to be a married woman. So we cannot be talking here about a shifcha, about a maid, who is designated to a slave. Because a shifcha, a maid designated to a slave, if she were free, then that designation would still not render her a married woman, because a free woman cannot marry a slave. A free man cannot marry a slave woman. If one tries to, if a free man takes a ring and puts it on a slave's finger, a slave woman's finger, and says, "Harei at mekudesh asli, you should be my wife," it does not work. It does not make them husband and wife. Or if he is a slave and she is free and he takes the ring and puts it on her finger, it does not make them husband and wife. It does not work. Can't happen. I mean, they can try, but it won't do anything. It doesn't make them married. So the case over here where the Torah is saying that the reason why she's not a married woman is because she is still a slave girl, but if she would have been freed, the designation would have made her a married woman and it would have been adultery, cannot be talking about her having a designation to a slave. It can't be. Now, it also can't be that she's designated to a free man, because then there's no such thing as designation. Designation implies that she is already spoken for, that she is already designated to a particular man. Well, she can't be designated to a free man, because there can't be a relationship between a free man and a slave girl. She could be designated to a slave man, but that wouldn't fit the other criterion, which is that if she were free, it would have been really adultery. So we have to find it takes a little bit of piecing together the puzzle over here. What is the case where, as long as she's a slave, it is a designation, but had she been freed, it would have been marriage? What case is that?
Is it Pestovar?
What's that?
That's from war.
And she's not a slave.
If she's brought from war, she's not a slave?
She's not a slave. She's just a, right? Okay. So the answer is that the man who she was designated to is an Eved Ivri. An Eved Ivri is a Jewish slave. Let's review the rules of slaves so we can understand what we're talking about over here. We've talked about it before, but it gets very confusing with the terminologies. Since we don't have slaves today, it's very hard to keep in mind what we're talking about. But remember, every morning you make a bracha, shalom asani aved, and you didn't make me a slave. What are we talking about with slavery? So let's explain what we're talking about. The Torah recognizes two types of slaves. One is a Jewish slave, or for that matter, a Jewish maid. That's called an Eved Ivri or an Amma Ivriya. That's one designation.
Is she Jewish?
Oh, okay. Wait. And the other one is, now, it's hard to say non-Jewish slave or maid, and you'll hear why in a moment. But the other one is what we call Eved Kenani or Shifcha Kenanis, a Canaanite slave. Now, doesn't have to be Canaanite, that's just the example used since the Jews were entering the land of Canaan. But really, it's any non-Jew. What is meant by a Canaanite or non-Jewish slave, male or female? It means that before they became a slave, they were not Jewish. So that means that a Jew purchased a slave from a non-Jew, meaning a non-Jew owned a non-Jewish slave, and the Jew purchased that slave from the non-Jew, or the Jews and non-Jews had a war, and the non-Jew was captured in war, became a POW, which, according to the rules of the Torah, becomes a slave. That's what you do with POWs. We talked about this once before, a long time ago, what you do with POWs is a confounding problem for a lot of countries. POWs represent a very big problem because what exactly are you supposed to do with your POWs? If you send them back to the country from where they came, all you're asking for is another war because you're giving them back their manpower and they'll turn around and fight you again. So you don't gain anything. So you're just opening yourself up to another battle. But if you keep them, they are a burden to society. What exactly are you supposed to do with them? They're your enemies. What are you supposed to do? Put them in jail? You're supposed to have a jail full of POWs? That's a pretty hefty burden for society to carry. So the Torah says when you capture POWs, they become your slaves. They work for you. They even have some rights. Not full rights, but they do have some rights. You cannot abuse them. And they work for you. That's what happens. That is a slave. So an Eved Kenani and a Shifcha Kenanis, this category of slave, is a slave that before they became your slave was not Jewish, male or female. Once you take possession of a non-Jewish slave, male or female, you are required to put them in the mikveh and make them into, ready for this, slaves. But what do you mean? They already are slaves. But the designation of slave is not the same thing as not Jewish. In those brachos you say in the morning, there is that you didn't make me a non-Jew and you didn't make me a slave. It's two different categories. The non-Jew that becomes your slave, you put them in the mikveh, they become obligated in mitzvos the same as a woman is obligated in mitzvos, which means they're not obligated in time-bound commandments, but they are obligated in all of the prohibitions and the non-time-bound commandments. So when you take your non-Jewish slave that you acquired, however you acquired him or her, you put them in the mikveh, whether they like it or not, it's a forcible conversion, sort of. It's not a full conversion. And they emerge from the mikveh, and now they are required to keep Shabbos. They are required to keep kosher. They are required to keep the laws of arayos, of immoral or prohibited relationships. They are required to keep all those laws. And that is the only forcible conversion that we do. They're still slaves, but they are somewhere in between non-Jew and Jew. If you ever free that slave, they become a full-fledged Jew. Just like a convert. They become a complete convert upon being freed. They can never go back to being a regular non-Jew. Once you are tovel them, once you immerse them, l'shem avdus, for the purpose of slavery, they are now locked in to either being slaves that are obligated in most mitzvos, or if they're eventually freed, to be like converts, full-fledged Jews. That is the category of Eved Kenani, Shifcha Kenanis, the male or female slave that started as a non-Jew. That is totally different than the Jewish slave, the Eved Ivri, or the Amma Ivriya. The Jewish slave was Jewish before they became your slave. You don't put them in the mikvah. They already are Jewish. And that's someone who, due to lack of money, sells themselves into slavery in order to be able to pay their debts. Or someone who steals money and is unable to pay back and is sold by the court into slavery in order to pay off the theft. But they are Jewish. And all rules of Judaism apply to them. There's no relaxation of any of the rules. They have to keep everything as they were before they became a slave. There is one major difference, though, between an Eved Ivri, a Jew who becomes a slave, and a totally free Jew in terms of keeping the mitzvos. One major prohibition changes. That is, the prohibition against, I don't want to say marrying, but having a relationship with a slave. A shifcha kenanis, a slave that became a slave as a non-Jew. Those non-Jews who become slaves, though, that's what I mean when I say a Jew, a free Jew, is not allowed to have a relationship with a slave. Either way, male, female, doesn't matter which way you go, a free, totally free Jew cannot have a relationship with a slave. But an Eved Ivri, a Jewish male, not female, but a Jewish male that becomes a slave, his master can force him to have a relationship with his non-Jewish, meaning female who became a slave when she was not Jewish. He can force the two of them to have a relationship and produce children, which will mean more slaves. It is not his wife. An Eved Ivri is not married to the Shifcha Kenanis, but it is a relationship that is permitted in the Torah. And that is what is meant here by this woman has been designated to a man. This Shifcha Kenanis, which is a female who became a slave when she wasn't Jewish, and now she has been in the mikvah for the purpose of being a slave, she's prohibited to a free Jew. But she is permitted to an Eved Ivri, to a Jew who becomes a slave. If she is designated to him, that's not marriage, but it is permitted. If she would receive her freedom, if her master would free her, then her designation to the Eved Ivri would be marriage. And that's the answer to the puzzle over here. The woman in question is a Shifcha Kenanis, is a woman who became a slave as a non-Jew. She is designated to another man. Who she designated to? To an Eved Ivri, to a Jew who became a slave. That designation is permitted, but it's not marriage. If another man has a relationship with her, it is not considered to be adultery. But had she received her freedom, and she's designated to the Eved Ivri, to the Jew who is a slave, and then another man has a relationship with her, that would be adultery. Because if she's free, and she's designated to the Eved Ivri, that's marriage. That's like any other woman and man who are designated to each other, and that would be adultery if someone else would have a relationship with her. There's one more twist over here, one more twist, that in order for this whole story to take place, in other words, in order for these laws to be in place, this is a shifcha, this is a maid, a non-Jewish maid, slave, who is half free and half slave. How does that happen to be half free and half slave? What happens if there are two owners and one frees her and one does not? So she is almost free, but not quite. She's getting there, but she's not quite there. She's designated a woman who is a shifcha, who is half free and half slave. She's prohibited even to another slave. A full slave cannot have a relationship with a half slave. A half-slave cannot have a relationship with a full-slave. This shifcha, this woman, half-slave and half-free, is off-limits to a totally free person and off-limits to a total slave person. Who on earth should she be able to have a family with? The only person she could have with is the Eved Ivri, is the Jew who is a slave. That's what we're talking about over here in these three psukim, these three verses in the Torah. And in that particular limited case, if another man should have a relationship with her, it is not adultery because she's not fully free yet. So therefore, she's not really married yet to the Eved Ivri, to the Jewish slave. But it is still prohibited for any other man to have a relationship with her. And if another man does, that man has to bring a karban. Now, what is not clear in the psukim, but the Gemara says, is the woman gets lashes. It's two different punishments. She is punished with lashes. He is punished with the karban. That is what happens over here in this particular limited case. I do not know of any other case where the two people involved in the relationship get different punishments, which means that if one was the aggressor and one was taken advantage of, we're not going to punish the one who was forced. Obviously, we're only going to punish the one who was the aggressor. But when it's consensual on both sides, then typically the punishment is the same all around. Whether it's death, whether it's lashes, whatever it is, whether it's a karban, it's typically going to be the same all around. This is the one example that I'm aware of. There is one other, but it's much more subtle than this. But this is the one that I'm aware of where it's a dramatically different punishment, where one gets lashes and one has to bring a karban. There is another case where the death penalty is different, a different death for the man and for the woman, with the bas kohen, with the daughter of a kohen that commits adultery. But that's, they both get killed, it's just that it's a different death. But here, it's a completely different punishment. Here, the woman will get lashes, the man will have to bring a karban. That is the very specific case that we're speaking about over here in the Torah. Yes?
So, Rabbi Kansky, this is very unpleasant, to say the least, because
it's a sin.
If a poor man lost his money and he's in debt, that's bad enough. And then, on top of that, he has to be enslaved in order to get the money back. I mean, it's good that he has a way to pay the money back, but to be forced, I mean, he could be married, and to be forced...
He must be married. He must be married.
Okay, so that really makes it even worse. So for him to be forced to have relations with another woman, just because he lost his money, maybe he couldn't even, maybe he wasn't just, you know, reckless, and maybe he didn't do the wrong thing, maybe it just happened. But for him to be forced to have relations with another woman, that's just...
It's not pleasant. There is a discussion in the Gemara whether that applies to a case where a person sells themselves into slavery, or it only applies to the case where they stole and they were sold because they couldn't pay back. Which there you can have less rachmanis on the person.
It's a whole new realm. Yeah. Whatever the situation was that got him there, that's bad enough. But this really exacerbates the situation.
Yep.
It's really...
It emphasizes his lack of freedom.
So, and then the poor woman, I mean, we're talking about the punishment. Well, the punishment, okay, that's a legitimate aspect. But what about this idea that you're dedicated to somebody else, and now, for whatever reason, you know, it's okay for you to have this relationship, and you're not going to be killed, but you have to have lashes or this. I mean, let's go to the basis of how they're behaving and how they're controlling their desires and everything. We're jumping over all the basis to what the punishment is. I mean, it's really very unpleasant
to
focus just on, you know, okay, this is what happened and now this is what we do. But wait a minute, let's think about, we're talking about human beings.
You're right.
And feelings.
You're right.
And it's really,
you're right.
It's all,
you're right. But that's the way the Torah always talks about it. When the Torah talks about adultery, it says you put him to death.
But why does she get a physical punishment with lashes and he gets the karma?
I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. The Torah here says this is the way the punishment goes. It's different, as I said. This is the only one I know of where it's that dramatic. The difference is so dramatic. I don't know why that's so.
Lashes are so much more painful than just
bringing a karma. You're right. You're right. Lashes is more painful. Doesn't cost any money. A karma is expensive.
Yes, yes.
Right? So, you know, I'm not sure why it's that way.
Are we talking about, I mean, everything's based on money today. You're saying money, everything.
No, but it's part of a punishment. It's a punishment. We're punishing people.
He was already punished because he didn't have the money. So now he's being punished with more money.
No. This is the person. This is the person.
Oh, the other one. Okay.
The person who took advantage. Who,
not the slave.
Right. He should not have done. The slave is permitted to her, the Eved Ivri. So this is the case. As I said, it's a jigsaw puzzle of the Gemara to work it through to figure it out, because the Torah doesn't give us that many details here. And this is the way it figures out what it means. And as I said, this is one of the ashams of the Torah. There are only a handful of ashams. This is one of them. We've had before. Did we have before? We had the asham of the mitzora, the person with tzaras, brings an asham. We'll have later the asham of the nazir, also brings an asham. We have a few different ashams, but this is one of them, where this case where the man has to bring an asham for this particular sin. Okay, that's the end of that paragraph. Okay, so we're going to stop over here.
Good.
At the end of the paragraph.
On that note, you want to stop.
The end of the paragraph. Okay, and Emir's Hashem, we'll pick it up after the Yom Tov.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it, so that he can continue that site.